We're doing the parsha. We left off with Shechem brings his girls. They play music outside Dina's tent. Dina walks outside to see the girls dancing. Shechem abducts her. He takes her forcibly. And then he comes to his father and says, I want to marry this girl. We mentioned that this seems to have been common practice in those days in Shechem, that the nobles would just ride over and pick up whatever girl they wanted, and the girl was considered fair game. If you were wealthy enough and you could just pay off her parents and pay off the family, you could do what you want. And Shechem and Hamor see that Yaakov isn't reacting and they're getting nervous. They know what Yaakov's grandfather did. They know that Yaakov has a big brother Esav. They know that this family isn't the family you want to mess around with. So they get nervous. And Yaakov doesn't reply because Yaakov knows that his kids are out in the field and they might not be aware to protect themselves. If he goes on the attack, he was ready to put his men together and go bring his daughter back forcibly. But he waited for his kids to come back. He said, I'm not going to do it when my children aren't aware of the lurking danger. So Shechem and Hamor come to Yaakov. And you'll notice that when they come, they don't bring Dina back. They did leave Dina locked up in the castle. And then they come and they say, Hamor is doing the talking initially. He says, my son really wants your daughter. Please give her to him as a wife. You'll marry us and you'll take whatever girls you want. And you'll give us in the future, you'll approve whichever daughters you want, you'll give us. They realize that they've erred here, because it's one thing to take a farmer's daughter and you're the king and you can do what you want. It's another thing to take Yaakov's daughter and do whatever you want. And they see these brave warriors, Yaakov's 11 children, even though their ages, I mean, Yosef is what, 7 years old? Shimon and Levi are what, 11, 12? But at that age, they were already formidable opponents, and they're going to prove it. And,
quick question.
Yeah.
Like, can we really take that literally?
The Pesukim are very clear about that age.
No, I understand that, but I mean, I guess, because we can only, I guess, really understand this with our experiences here. And, like, this, the experience I have, I don't know about you, but, like, a 7 and a 10-year-old cannot do what these guys did. And, you know,
how old was Cleopatra when there was a world war fought over her?
What?
How old was Cleopatra when there was a world war fought over her?
But isn't that different, though?
Because of her beauty?
That's different, though, because, like, you can be beautiful, she's not doing anything, she's just sitting back being beautiful.
Right, but you see that in ancient times, Nathan, at what age do people in Africa go out to work?
Six years old,
they're out in the field.
Again, I think that's different, though. Taking down a whole neighborhood?
I read in the Guinness Book of World Record that there was these two mafia kids, at the age of five, not two gangsters in the age of five, they were running a whole, like, show.
In South America also, I mean, if you go now...
All over the world, I'm sure you know that.
Anywhere but the Western cultures.
Child soldiers all around the world. Kids, 7 years old.
No, you're probably right. I mean, I guess we're still babies in America.
I can't believe it.
America as well, all the Western cultures. They mature differently. Like, at 13, 14, a girl can be a mother in South America and in Africa.
Everywhere.
In India, So... we also see that they were unusual. I mean, Yaakov rolls over a stone when he's 60 years old, that it takes a bunch of shepherds to roll off that stone. So they were unusual. Rivka gets married at 3. You know, what does that mean? So things were different then. The Gemara even says things were different, because the Gemara questions how young a person can be before he could procreate. And then the Gemara proves from the genealogy in Bereishis that the forefathers, Yehuda and his children, they each had children at the age of 7. So the Gemara says, but a kid, 7-year-old, can't have children. So the Gemara says, you're right, but they could. They were different. they matured more quickly. They were different. They were anomalies. For better and for worse. Look, Sarah didn't have a womb. What does that mean? Sarah didn't have a womb. She couldn't have a child. It wasn't a matter of, you know, this way or that way, this type of fertility treatment or that. She didn't have a womb. That's what Chazal say. No potential for children. You're talking about something like Adam starting from scratch. Adam is formed by God. Yitzhak is a creation of a miracle. Miracle. It's not, no logical explanation. So the children also were unusual. So they come and they offer them this deal. And they say, look, ask us for a lot of money. We understand you feel you've been wronged. So they tell them it's not a matter of money. You know, when you take money, then it's indicative. It's just a matter of price. But it degrades all of us. But the only way we're going to do this is if you all circumcise. Otherwise, we it'll look bad. If we're all for money, we're willing to forgo what you did. Now, what were they thinking? Machlokas. Some say they were thinking they'll never agree. They'll never get the people to agree to have an operation just because Shechem wants to marry our daughter. And then they'll say, okay, tough nuggies, give us our daughter back, and they'll leave. Yaakov and the siblings were thinking they'll do circumcision. Everyone will be out. We're going to be able to walk into the palace and take our daughter. And we'll kill Shechem and Hamor, because he definitely, I mean, for what he did, he deserves to be killed. But the rest of the city, you know, there we'll leave him be. Now, what's the idea of circumcising everyone? Seems like a funny thing. You know, Yosef comes into Egypt, they run out of food. Yosef says, you want food, you have to circumcise. Why? You know, all the Egyptians circumcise.
Navid says these are circumcised people.
But they them, right, the Philistines. What?
They refer to them as uncircumcised.
Right. But I'm saying here, what were they thinking? What gain is there if Yaakov thinks we're going to walk away from here with Dina and leave all of them circumcised? Right? We'll take advantage of their weakness and we'll walk away with Dina. What's the gain? Why is Yosef so insistent that the Egyptians all circumcise? So David HaMelech, when he describes the circumcision, he calls it, he says, Sasa nochi alimratecha, I rejoice over your commandment, kemotzei shalal rav, like one who found great loot. What's the best loot you could get at war? The best loot is when you go to war and you come back with their weapons. Meaning, if you get money, so it has value. But if you come back with their weapons, you walk back stronger and they walk back weaker. Meaning, if you won a battle, you ended up collecting all their tanks, all their weapons, now you could attack them with their own weapons, you walk back stronger, they walk back weaker. So, shalal rav, the greatest loot is what? When you have their weaponry. So David HaMelech says, the bris milah I rejoice over like someone who found the greatest loot. What happens when a person circumcises? He has less sensitive skin. His sensitivities and his desire are more tame. He's different than someone who's uncircumcised. So today, a lot of research shows that this is so. If you have less skin, so a person has less sensitivity, he has less pleasure, he has less desire. There is an effect that goes that way. We also know that it's healthy. Today, science has proven that it's very, very healthy to be circumcised. When they're circumcising the people of Shechem, when Yosef tells the Egyptians to circumcise, it might be the hidden message was, if you'll circumcise, you'll have slightly decreased desire, you'll be more capable of controlling it. The Egyptians were sleeping with everyone. You didn't know who's... When women gave birth, no one knew whose child it was. Yeah, she was married to him, but who knows how many people she slept with when he was sleeping with their wives. So the people of Shechem were also immoral. They condoned this. No one got up. No one took him to the Supreme Court. Yaakov didn't have a court he could sue their king in. He didn't have a court to turn to. He didn't have a system to work with. Yaakov and his children want to deal with this legally. Okay, the man did something wrong. There has to be a legal system. No legal system is willing to touch Shechem and Hamor. So they look at the system and they say, wait a second, what's going on here? So you guys are condoning this. They do a little bit of research. They realize, yeah, this is normal practice. They look back and say, wait a second, we've gone back to the generations before the flood. What does the Torah describe? What happened there? Why did God say they have to be destroyed? Because whoever had power would take the other people's wives and daughters. They said, that's what's happening here in Shechem. No legal system is willing to back us. We have no choice. We have no way of dealing with these people. They haven't come and said, look, this is wrong. Let's work something out. No. They left the daughter locked up in their palace. And then they come and say, now what deal do you guys want to do? What are we supposed to answer? So they have to answer with cunning. Yaakov's plan was, when they'll be weakened, we'll take our daughter back and we'll leave. His children, they had a different plan. Two children. Shimon and Levi. So they tell them, circumcise. And if you don't circumcise, we're going to take our daughter and leave. And when they hear this, they say, okay. So Shechem rushes to convince everyone. And they all undergo this very, very painful operation. Everyone's lying in bed, wallowing in pain, the third day after circumcision. Like the Gemara says, Gadol, an elder, a person who's older, so his flesh doesn't have haya, the Gemara calls it. It doesn't heal quickly. You know, there's a lot more flesh to heal. On a baby, when you do circumcision, the amount of skin that needs to heal, if it's done properly, is, look at your knuckles, right? You see the creases in between your knuckle? Like in between two creases. And that's a lot. I mean, I did a circumcision 3 weeks ago where it was my nephew. So I went to see the baby afterwards. It was about a quarter of that. It's like a thin line. That's all that was left to heal. On a baby, think about how much that is to heal. That's nothing. A day or two later, the baby's out of it. An adult, there's a lot of skin that has to grow and reattach. There's a whole area that has to heal. So, sorry if I'm scaring you guys.
Thanking God.
So they're lying in bed, and in those days they didn't have anesthesia like they have today. And Shimon and Levi take their swords, they walk into the city and kill all the men. And Hamor and Shechem, who had been in hiding, they killed them too. And they take Dina and they leave. And then the rest of the family jumps into the city, and they'd all been seething. So they took all the wealth and they come back home. And Yaakov turns to Shimon and Levi and says, you've disgraced me. You've endangered me. You've shamed me. What's everyone going to say? We're liars. Everyone's going to say, we made a deal. We went back on our end of the deal. They said, are we going to let him just treat our sister like a woman of ill repute? She's our sister. And if anyone would look at this case, honestly, if it was anyone but the UN, they'd see that we're just. And Yaakov knows better. Yaakov knows that the world is like the UN. If they're going to have room to interpret it badly, they will. And Chazal say, there are different midrashim here as to what happened. There's a midrash that says there was a world war. The nations all around, Shechem had peace treaties with other nations, and when they heard what happened, they all joined forces and attacked. And Yaakov had to stand up there and fight with his children and protect themselves. There were wars. There were other nations that said, what do you guys think you're doing? You just entered this country. You're going to start threatening us. Who are you? You kill out a whole people? You trick them? Well, you didn't trick us. That's why Yaakov Avinu later on feels he has a right to give Shechem over to Yosef. He says to Yosef, I'll give you that portion which I caught with my bow and arrow and my sword. So Chazal say, what do you mean he took with his bow and arrow and his sword? Chazal say, yeah, there was a war. There's a whole midrash about the wars that ensued after they killed them. But the simple reading of the Psukim, Hashem tells Yaakov, go to Beit El and bring a sacrifice and I'll protect you. And then Hashem made all the nations all around be scared. And they didn't attack because they said, wait a second. The most logical thing for Yaakov to do would be to enter Shechem, which is a fortified city, stay within the walls of Shechem in case we attack. Yaakov does the exact opposite. He walks brazenly out and he's taking this long journey. So they all trembled. They said, what's going on here? He's not scared of us. If he's not scared of us, then we should be scared of him. So when they heard that Yaakov left Shechem, he left the city where he had ample protection, he had everything they had there, everything was his now, they all got scared. Yaakov said, take everything you took, all the loot from Shechem, and bury it. Even though technically if a Gentile has idols, his wife, his children can annul those idols. That's why David in his army, he had Ittai Agiti, Ittai, the Philistine from Gat, and he never gave him Gerus. Ittai never became a Ger. Every time they take, they capture idols, they give it over to Ittai, and Ittai would say, this is nonsense, this is no longer an idol, break off an ear off the idol. Now, David, you could enjoy it. So that's why David got his crown. David had a special crown, which had a bar going through the middle, and the people from the Davidic dynasty had a little slit in their head that no one else had, and only they could wear this crown. So where did he get that crown from? It was a very, very heavy crown. It was off of an idol's head. How was he allowed to use it? Because Ittai Agiti annulled the idol. So all the wealth they took from Shechem, they had to be worried. Maybe it was designated for idols. But being that the wives of the people of Shechem and the rest of their family, a non-Jew can annul the idol of another non-Jew. But Yaakov says, I don't care. I don't want it in our midst. Then he says, let's bury it. And that's why they buried it. Because technically, if it was really idol worship, if it was really stuff that was designated for idol worship, they'd have to destroy it. Burying it wouldn't be enough. The reason they could get away with burying it was because it was no longer designated for that use. Other non-Jews annulled it from that use. So it's called in Chazal Bitu. So Yaakov commands them to bury it. They bury it, and it is going to be found later on after the destruction of the first temple up at Mount Gerizim. It is going to be found by the Kutim, the Shomronim. They're going to find this wealth, and they're going to find the figurine of a dove, and they're going to designate the dove as their god. And for about a century, for generations, during the period of the Second Temple, there were these mak geirim, these people who did gear out of a threat, right? You guys know the story of the Kutim? In a nutshell. When the Jews were exiled during the destruction of the First Temple, the king brought in other people to inhabit the land when the 10 tribes were exiled. So Sancheirov, who exiled the northern 10 tribes, brought in people from the island of Kavta and other areas to settle the land of Israel. They, because they came from the place of Kavta, they were called Kutim. Now these Kutim, their capital was Shomron. So they were also known as Shomironim, because Shomron was their capital. Now, when they started living in the land of Israel, God sent lions. Ordinarily, we don't have lions roaming the streets here, right? This isn't a jungle. This is Israel. But God sent lions, and the lions started attacking them. So they sent word to Sancheirov. They said, we need instructions how you serve the God of Israel, because he sent lions to attack us. So he ordered a Kohen back from the exile to teach them how to be Jewish. And the Kohen taught them how to be Jewish, monotheists, etc. And they adopted some of the practices of the Jews, and some they didn't. When the Jews came to rebuild the second Beit HaMikdash, they attacked them. They said, who are you? We're the real Jews. Where have you been? We know what Judaism is all about. You guys don't know. And they attacked us. They wouldn't let us build the Beit HaMikdash. Finally, we rebuilt the Beit HaMikdash, and they kept up their practices. And throughout the period of the second Beit HaMikdash, down to the time of Rabbi Meir, till after the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash, you have a few centuries where the rabbis questioned, are these Kutim real Jews or not? Did they ever do a real giyur? So yeah, they did a real giyur later. Did they mean it or didn't they mean it? So you have Mishnayot that discuss if a kuti bakes matzah, is it kosher or not? The Gemara says they didn't accept the tradition like we do, so we couldn't trust them on mitzvot. Now, ordinarily, if a guy comes to do giyur and says, I won't accept the rabbinic mitzvot, or I won't accept the minagim, so we say his giyur is invalid. No giyur. But here, the original generations did a giyur that we weren't certain about. And the later generations were already not sincere about keeping the rabbinic mitzvot. So we remained in limbo, uncertain about whether they were Jews or non-Jews, until Rabbi Meir's time, when they did a lot of research, and they went up to Mount Gerizim, and they found that they had a figurine of a dove all the way back to Yaakov Avinu's time, this wealth that they buried, and that figurine of the dove, in hiding, that was what they were worshipping. And they came to the conclusion that they were pagans. They weren't, their gear wasn't good, it was invalidated retroactively, everything was gone, they weren't Jews. But where did they get all this from? From this loot that Yaakov buried. This loot that Yaakov buried, among it was figurines of doves, and when they discovered that, they decided the dove is a holy thing for them, and they worshiped that. As Yaakov's traveling, he gets word that his mother died. And when his mother died, out of respect for her, they buried her that night. He wasn't around, Esav wasn't around, Yitzhak was blind at home. The servants took her body, went into the Maris HaMachpelah and buried her. Why'd they do that? They said, if we wait till tomorrow, we make a proper funeral. Yaakov can't come, it's a long distance. Esav, who wants him? We'll make a public burial, people will start talking. Ah, that's the mother of Esav. Everyone's going to say, cursed is that woman. What kind of child came out of her? A murderer, a rapist. Esav was raping married women left and right. So they, out of honor for Rivka, they hid her burial. They didn't want anyone to come and talk about the fact that she had a son like Esav. And when Yaakov heard that his mother, the tzaddikes, what an amazing woman, that kind of burial, that's what she had. So Yaakov wept deeply. Hashem appears, blesses him with the name Yisrael, and then he loses his favorite wife, Rachel. And Rachel dies in the middle of childbirth. Because she dies in the midst of childbirth, so it's a gory death, and if they'd start traveling with her body, then it would be gory for her, so he has no choice. He has to bury her there by the roadside, even though he has no choice. After her burial, out of respect for her, they buried her right away, but right after her burial, he sets up the tomb over Rachel, Matseva. And that's Kever Rachel till today, the Torah says.
What is gory?
I don't know.
Bloody.
When a woman dies during childbirth, so it's a very bloody death. He travels, and then we have the story of Reuven and Bila. Simple reading is Reuven slept with Bila. That's what the pasuk says. Chazal had a tradition that that's not what happened. What happened was when Rachel died, Yaakov moved his bed from Rachel's tent. He had a permanent place where his bed was, and he moved it to her maid, to Bila's tent. Remember, he had married Bila. Reuven said, what's going on here? When my mother was, when there were two wives, Rachel and Leah, so he loved Rachel better. But now that Rachel died, instead of going to his second wife, he goes to Bila. He took the bed and moved it to his mother's tent. Yaakov says, what kind of chutzpah? You're getting involved in my, where I put my bed? You the son? And the pasuk right away says, Yaakov had 12 sons, and names them all, and names Reuven the Bechor. Reuven is the one that teaches us what tshuva is all about. Reuven made a mistake. Pachas kamayim, he was quick as water flowing down to protect his mother's honor, but he did teshuva. It's interesting, the description of his avera, we find, this isn't the only time that we find that the Torah uses harsh terms to describe an avera. We find it in the book of Shmuel also. Chazal point out how hard Reuven worked on his tshuva. Who was the one to tell Yaakov who did it? Who's the one that told Yaakov who moved the bed? Yosef. And that's why next week's parsha is going to begin with the enmity that the brothers developed towards Yosef, and it starts here, when Rachel dies. After everything, when the bed is moved, so she's going to tell Yaakov what to do?
She's going to tell Reuven what to do.
Ah.
My tent, get out.
So some of the Mefarshim say that the Shevatim didn't feel any threat by the maids. They still knew you were a maid. And there's even an opinion that says that when the maids bowed, their own children wouldn't bow. They said, you married our father as a maid. I'm not the son of the maid. I'm the son of Yaakov. I don't bow to Esav. The Torah ends with a description of the genealogy of Esav. The Ramban in Drashat Torat Hashem Temima says that the reason the Torah goes to such detail describing the genealogy of Esav is because we have a mitzvah to wipe out Amalek. The Torah wanted to ensure that no innocent bystanders would be hurt. So the Torah says, I want you to know an exact recording who is Amalek and the rest of this huge family that's not Amalek. So that you, when you come and you have a mitzvah to wipe out Amalek, you'll be very careful. Because the Torah took great pains. At the end of the parasha, we have some 25-30 psukim just describing the genealogy of Esav to ensure that when we come to do it, we give it proper care to avoid hurting those that aren't part of Amalek. Yeah, Brett, you want something?
Earlier, you said that Rivka died. Didn't Deborah die?
Yeah. Chazal say, that's why it's called Bachut, that's why it's there were multiple crimes. The Torah covers up the passing of Rivka, yeah.
Okay.
It was like hidden.
Okay.
Yeah.
Rashi brings that the reason why Yaakov picked up and left to go back to Israel
was because he had to fulfill his vow to build the altar.
Okay.
But I think you said last night that he didn't have to fulfill that because he never returned to his father's house.
Until he returned to his father's house. God told him to do it now, in this prophecy.
He told him to go back to his father's house.
He told him, go build the altar you promised. We said he started building something when he first came into Shechem. He finished it now. We didn't go into that, but he did finish building it when he went to Bethel. When he returned to Bethel, he finished building it. Set up a temple. Okay. I didn't understand what?